You graduated from Oxford in 1938 and then went to Princeton to work with Henry Eyring. Can you tell us how this came about?
During my last year at Oxford, of course, I had to give some thought to the question of what I was going to do afterwards. I could, of course, just have taken a job at that time. And in fact, Hobbs, whom I've mentioned before, he did in fact do that. He went into industry right away, and a number of students did that. I didn't particularly want to go into industry right away. I did want to continue to take a higher degree, and I applied for a fellowship to remain at Oxford and remain working with Hinshelwood. I also applied for a Commonwealth Fund fellowship to take me over to the United States. Now, I think part of the reason that I did that was that it happened that a member of my family had obtained a Commonwealth Fund fellowship a few years previously, so I didn't know all about them, and he had talked to me about his own happy experiences at an American university. He went to MIT. I, in fact, suggested to Hinshelwood that perhaps I should apply for a Commonwealth Fellowship, and he thought it was a reasonable idea. And so I did apply. He wrote a letter of recommendation, which I assume was a reasonable one, because I was awarded the fellowship. Now, an interesting point about that is that my first choice was the California Institute of Technology to work with Pauling, and my second choice was Princeton to work with Eyring. When I went for the interview in London, those who were interviewing me said, "Would I consider going to Princeton instead of to Caltech?" The reason being that so many of the fellows were going to Caltech, were going to California, various universities in California, and they wanted to spread them around a little, and they thought that since I had given Princeton as a strong second choice, that they'd never had anyone before who had worked with Eyring, and they were very pleased at the idea that someone from England was going to work with Eyring on a Commonwealth Fellowship, and so they asked me if that was acceptable, and of course I said indeed it was, and so they appointed me to the fellowship to work at Princeton. And of course, as it turned out, I was very pleased at the fact that I was able to do that. I'm sure I would have enjoyed working with Pauling, but the work with Eyring was really rather more in my line, as it turned out.
Which brings me beautifully to the next point. We were all sad at Professor Eyring's death in 1982.
I think it was in December of 1981.
81?
I think so. Yes, I think it must have been. Yes.
81. So it makes your memories of him even more precious. Could you describe him, his personality, his method of working?
Yes. I knew, of course, a little about Eyring when I first went to Princeton. I had seen him because he did give a seminar at Oxford when I was an undergraduate, although I did not, in fact, have a chance to speak to him at that time. I was only, I think, in my third year, but I saw him. I found him, of course, a very lively lecturer. Hinshelwood had always spoken very highly of him. At the end of this lecture, I might mention as an aside that Lindemann, Professor Lindemann, who was professor of physics at Oxford at my time, was asked some rather aggressive and unpleasantly worded questions of Eyring, which caused some annoyance and embarrassment to the people present. This, of course, was somewhat Lindemann's style. And Hinshelwood, I remember Hinshelwood afterwards commenting on what Lindemann had done, feeling that it was very bad taste, of course, to treat a visiting professor in that way. So that was my only previous knowledge of Henry Eyring. And when I arrived at Princeton, of course, I think I probably first went to see H.S. Taylor, who was chairman of the department, and he was very, very pleasant, and I had corresponded with him a little about the department, telling him I was coming and so forth. He'd written a very nice letter in reply to that, I remember. So then I arrived at Princeton and went to see Taylor, and then went up to see Henry Eyring. And I was course, taken with him right away. What struck me as quite remarkable, coming from Oxford perhaps, the contrast was so great, was his extraordinary friendliness. I mean, he treated me as a friend from the very first time I saw him. He immediately said, "Everybody calls me Henry. You call me Henry, won't you?" And he called me Keith. So that was it, within 5 minutes or so. And he was, throughout the time, he was a friend as well as a research director. His office, I was in an office next to his. We were along a corridor, and he was in one office, and I think the office I was in was just as big as his. His was not a particularly large office, but everyone seemed to be treated in the same way. And his door was always open, and people wandered in and out all through the day. And if Henry Eyring ever found himself alone, he would go walk along the corridor and invite somebody in, or perhaps just go into somebody else's office and sit down and talk. He did his research very largely just by talking to people and using the blackboard, of course, working out things on the blackboard. And he was always producing ideas. Many of them were quite unreasonable and wrong, and in some cases we were able to show him that they were wrong, or that he was saying things that were in fact well known. He always took this very well. But a certain proportion of the ideas he threw out were very stimulating. Some of them needed further work. Sometimes the further work indicated that they weren't worth pursuing anymore. But in a small proportion of the cases, his ideas did turn out to be extremely fruitful. And this was really the way he operated. It was quite an extraordinary way to me. It was quite different from anything I'd experienced before, because Hinshelwood was a complete contrast. I mean, Hinshelwood would never really say anything unless he'd worked it all out carefully in his mind. He wouldn't blurt out an idea. Everything he said, he worked out extremely carefully. Eyring was just the other extreme. He just blurted out anything that came into his mind, and it was the duty of his graduate students and other research assistants to sort them out, to work on them, to tell him if they were wrong, but if they were right, to develop them in some way. So that really is the way the work proceeded throughout, I would say. And he assigned me, when I first arrived, he assigned me a problem on constructing a partition function for water, which was not kinetics at all, as a matter of fact. But he was quite keen, because he knew of my interest in reactions and solution, and he was quite keen, perhaps, to pursue that. Well, we didn't get anywhere with that. It soon became apparent after a short time that was not the time was not ripe for developing a partition function for water. In fact, I'm not sure the time is still ripe. It's a very, very complicated problem, and so it didn't lead to any results. Certainly no publishable results, but of course it was very useful training for me, because up to then I didn't know very much about partition functions in any case. I didn't know an awful lot of statistical mechanics. I'd had a course at Oxford, but I didn't know a great deal about it. So I had to learn statistical mechanics as I went along. And when he saw that wasn't working, then there was a meeting of the New York Academy of Sciences in which they wanted a paper on reactions and solutions. So he asked me to collaborate with him on that, and I did that. And also we got working on reactions on surfaces. I don't remember how that came up. It may be that H.S. Taylor suggested to Eyring that would be a useful problem. So we applied the theory of the what is now called transition state theory, but which he called then absolute reaction rate theory. We applied that to reactions on surfaces. A year after I arrived, this would be in the summer of 1939, Samuel Gladstone came to Princeton. Gladstone was an electrochemist who had been at Sheffield University in England, decided to leave England and go to the United States, and so he arrived at Princeton without any particular position, although he did get an appointment at Princeton fairly quickly, I believe. But he arrived and was interested in collaborating with Eyring. And since he was an electrochemist, he pointed out to us that the problem of overvoltage was one that had not been satisfactorily dealt with by reaction rate theory. So that was another problem that I worked on with Gladstone, as well as with Eyring. As a matter of fact, we collaborated on that. We wrote a couple of papers in which all three of us were authors.
I'd like to come back to these two people that you've been talking about, Eyring and Gladstone, a little bit more later. But coming back to the general scene at Princeton, Hirschfelder has described the 1930s as a golden age for theoretical chemistry, and you, of course, just overlapped with this period. Who were your colleagues and other teachers at Princeton, and how was the graduate course run?
The system at Princeton was in some ways not unlike that at Oxford, in the sense that lectures were not compulsory. One did not have, at that time, one was not required to take graduate courses. Undergraduates, of course, I believe, had to take lecture courses, but graduate students did not have compulsory courses. But on the other hand, of course, it was considered desirable to take lecture courses if one was going to obtain a PhD degree. I might say that when I first went to Princeton, it was not my intention to take the PhD. I really just intended to work with Eyring on the search. I didn't think I'd have time to take the PhD degree as well. But I realized that probably I could manage it, and I did in the end manage it all right, because of the fact that the lecture courses were not demanding. There were no assignments, for example, so one learnt, really learnt by oneself, and took a comprehensive examination at the end, and of course submitted a thesis. So I was able to do that in the 2 years that I had, which would probably not have been possible if there had been demanding courses to take at the same time with lots of assignments. So that was all good as far as I was concerned. But of course I did attend a number of lectures at Princeton. I certainly took H.S. Taylor's lectures on kinetics, which were extremely well organized. He was an extremely good lecturer. And that was a very profitable experience. I took Eyring's course. He gave, of course, one term in quantum mechanics and another term in statistical mechanics. I certainly took those. These were a great experience. I might say that Eyring was probably one of the world's worst lecturers.
You anticipate me.
That's going too far. Now, Ansager and Bohr were probably the world's worst lecturers that I ever heard. But Eyring was not good. He was so informal that it didn't really matter very much if one wanted to learn, because he didn't mind if one interrupted him in the middle of a lecture. Of course, the class was small. I remember only about probably fewer than a dozen people there. The class was small, and he was, of course, so pleasant and informal that if you didn't understand anything, you would just say, "Well, look, Henry, you're going too fast, or you're getting this all muddled. Could you go over this again?" And he would take it in perfectly good part, and he'd go over it again. So with the help of interruptions of that kind, he did get the subject matter across. And I had taken a course in quantum mechanics at Oxford, but I didn't really feel I understood the subject at all. Of course, the subject was still somewhat ill-digested. There weren't many books on quantum mechanics then, if any. Dirac's book, I suppose, was out, but that was rather formidable. Pauline, I'm sorry, Pauline and Wilson, of course, had come out, and that was a great help. I think it probably only came out at about the time I went to Princeton, so I don't think I studied Pauline and Wilson before I went to Princeton. But at any rate, with the aid of Pauline and Wilson, plus Aring's lectures, I did manage to get a good grasp of the subject. Now, the statistical mechanics was the same. I never felt I had a great grasp of it, but Aring did it in a very informal way. He didn't go through formal proofs very much, but he gave us an insight into what one can do with statistical mechanics. And of course, that's terribly important, because you can get the formal treatments from the textbooks, but the insights into what the subject can do are more important in many ways. And Aring was very good at instilling these insights into people. So those were courses from in physical chemistry. And I'm trying to remember. I took courses in organic and inorganic chemistry. I had to do some of that. Now, I didn't do as much of that, but I knew I was going to be examined in these topics. I had a pretty good background from my undergraduate days, so I didn't have to work perhaps tremendously hard on the other two subjects. So then, of course, in the end, I wrote up my thesis. Now, my thesis largely, since we'd written the book, Theory of Rate Processes was in manuscript, my thesis was really largely taken from the Theory of Rate Processes. Together with Princeton had a very good, easy way of allowing one to write a thesis. It was permitted then simply to put one's reprints together as a thesis. And so I do remember that the reprint of the paper on overvoltage was part of my thesis, and also chapters that we had written on quantum mechanics and so on, reaction on reactions in solution and reactions on surfaces, parts of them were included. And this of course was slightly anomalous, because I wasn't the sole author of any of this, but Princeton had a very liberal attitude to this, and this was quite acceptable. The fact that Gladstone and Aring, well, particularly Gladstone had done a substantial amount of the writing, of course. I mean, I had written parts of these sections, but Gladstone had certainly written quite a lot, and he was an extremely good writer, so that I couldn't really claim the thesis was entirely my own. That didn't seem to bother the Princeton authorities, which was a relief, because that might have presented a difficulty, because I didn't really want to rewrite everything. It would have been rather a waste of time if I'd had to take it and write it all out in my own words, especially since some of it was already in my own words.
You've already mentioned H.S. Taylor. Taylor was, of course, British. Could you backtrack a little and talk a little bit about H.S. Taylor?
Yes. Taylor, as you say, well, he was born in England. He went to Liverpool University, and he got his PhD degree, or perhaps it was called Doctor of Science degree, at Liverpool University. He came under the influence of Donnan, and of course he then went to work with Max Bodenstein, the famous German kineticist, and then shortly before the war, the First World War, I believe it was, before the First World War, he came over to Princeton, came over to the United States. I think, I'm not sure he went to Princeton first, but anyway, he had been at Princeton for a very long period of time, and was then known to be a very distinguished kineticist. And he was chairman of the department when I was a graduate student.
You attended a course of lectures on kinetics given by H.S. Taylor, these notes I've seen, and it's interesting how closely they follow his textbook on physical chemistry. Could you tell us a little bit about his lectures?
Yes, I I remember them quite clearly, and as you say, I still have retained the my lecture notes of his lecture, so that we do know, of course, what field he covered, what material he covered. I was impressed, and still am impressed, as to how modern his approach was. Of course, I must say, Hinchwood had been also extremely modern. Taylor, of course, was perhaps more enthusiastic about transition state theory, as we call it now, about Eyring's theories, and Taylor had been instrumental getting Eyring's paper, Eyring's 1935 paper, published in the Journal of Chemical Physics, because Eyring had difficulties, of course, with the referees. Taylor intervened strongly, and the paper was published early in 1935. So Taylor was very, very familiar, of course, with the with transition state theory and with the related work of Polanyi and Wigner, which had been done just about the time, a few years before. So he covered these matters in his lectures. I remember he spent quite a bit of time on Polanyi's experimental studies in the 1930s on the reactions of sodium atoms with chlorine and so on, the atomic reactions. Polanyi had wrote a book called Atomic Reactions, and Taylor was obviously much impressed by this particular study, and he emphasized that work very much. Of course, he also covered in very considerable detail catalysis, reactions on surfaces. He himself, of course, did a great deal of important work on catalysis. He was responsible for the idea of active centers on surfaces, and for the idea of activated adsorption. The fact was that there would be an activation energy associated with an absorption process. This was, of course, of very great importance in clarifying the ideas of the different kinds of adsorption, chemisorption and physical adsorption. And, of course, all these things Taylor brought out in his lectures, and he covered the different orders of reaction, the kinetics of reactions on surfaces. So those are the things that stand out most in my mind as to the things that he covered in his lectures.
I'd like to come back in a little while to some of the points you've already raised in connection with the transition state theory, but to round off what we've been saying about colleagues and teachers at Princeton, who else do you recall?
Oh, I should have mentioned RNPs. P-E-A-S-E, RNPs, who also was doing research in kinetics. He was a gas kineticist. He was working on free radical reactions at that time, and I don't remember that I went to a course of lectures. He may not, in fact, have given a course of lectures in kinetics. I don't remember going to his lectures, but I remember him very much. Well, as a person, I very often spoke to him. The Princeton chemistry department was quite small at that time. Of course, in my day, the Princeton Graduate School was restricted to 250 graduate students in all subjects. And so there were probably not more than about 20 graduate students in chemistry, and there were a few postdoctorates, but it was very, very small. And the result was that, of course, one could easily get to know everyone. And so I knew many of the professors personally, just by meeting in the corridor, and everyone was always extremely friendly. And I certainly remember Pease as being extremely friendly and easy to talk to. Another person I remember very well is Smythe, S-M-Y-T-H, H-D Smythe, who worked on dipole moments. He was an extremely pleasant man, and very, of course, very able. He did very, very distinguished work on dipole moments, wrote a book on dipole moments. I remember him as always being very friendly, and so on. And then there was one person who was not really in my field at all, but who was exceptionally kind to me, and as was his wife, that was A.W.C. Menzies, M-E-N-Z-I-E-S, spelt Menzies, but pronounced Menzies, Scottish name, and he was a Scotsman, although he was in his 60s when I was a graduate student, he still had such a strong Scottish accent that the Princeton undergraduates had a little difficulty with his lectures at first until they got used to him. But he and his wife were delightful people, and they made me most welcome at their house. And in fact, almost every Saturday evening I would spend having a dinner with them, and I would spend the evening there. So that was a very pleasant experience. But I didn't... He had worked on osmotic pressure. That was one of his one of the things he had done in early. He was a somewhat classical chemist, somewhat old-fashioned, one might say. So I didn't actually attend any of his lectures, but I was aware of his earlier, very much earlier work. He did some rather pioneering work on the measurement of osmotic pressure, so probably about the turn of the century. But he wasn't doing a great deal of research at that time, but he was an extremely strong influence in the department. One other person I should mention at Princeton is Hubert Allier, who H.N. Allier, H.N. I think are the initials, Allier, A-L-Y-E-A. Allier is still at Princeton, as far as I know. He was a young, probably an assistant professor when I was there, and he had done some kinetic work in his time. He worked with Bäckström in Stockholm, I think. But he decided he didn't want to continue to do research, and so he, with the full approval of his department, went into the field of education in chemistry, and he devoted himself to the teaching of chemistry, particularly undergraduate, in fact, exclusively really undergraduate teaching. His first year course in chemistry was quite famous, and it was remarkable for the fact that he did an extraordinarily large number of demonstrations in his lecture. He spent, of course, a great deal of time preparing each lecture. I mean, each lecture must have taken several hours to prepare, and he had a great many demonstrations which were very, very interesting and striking. And also, he was a most entertaining person. He ought to have been on the stage. Well, it's a sense he was on the stage, because his lectures were stage performances. Before Christmas, the final lecture of the session was what he called a review lecture. And the only trouble about that was that it was very difficult to get a seat. Because not only did the undergraduates all want to go, but a lot of the professors in all fields in the university wanted to go, and their wives and their children, and all sorts of people who had no connection with the course all piled into the lecture room to hear this and see this remarkable lecture. And I think he claimed that he, and this is probably true, that he did 60 demonstrations in 60 minutes. And it really was the most extraordinary performance, because the stage was set, the lecture bench was covered with apparatus, and he went from one to the other. He knew exactly where everything was. There was no delay at all. He did explosion after explosion, flashes of flame, and all sorts of things. It was really entertainment. There was no review in it. It was really a stage performance. But that, of course, brought him a lot of publicity, and he has, of course, been going for many, many years since then. He's been going around the United States and Canada to some extent, and maybe other countries, as far as I know, giving these remarkable demonstration lectures. And so he has done a great deal for the teaching of chemistry, and he's devised kits for to help chemistry teachers in schools teach chemistry. He's devised kits where with a minimum of equipment you can do a maximum of experiments.
Hmm. That's really interesting.
Those are the ones, those are the professors at Princeton I remember. There may be one or two others I've forgotten, but that's quite a group, I think, of them, you know. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to bring these two personalities you've already mentioned, H.S. Taylor and Henry Eyring, together. As you've already said, Taylor played a role in the eventual publication of Eyring's 1935 paper on the transition state theory, but Taylor himself has described these years at Princeton with Henry Eyring as his golden years, and he has said that he was inspired by Eyring's personality. The transition state theory took place a little bit before you arrived in Princeton,
yeah.
But could you fill in a little bit more about it before you arrived and after? What stage was it at when you...
The paper, of course, appeared in 1935, and I arrived in 1938, so there had been a three-year gap. Of course, during that period, a great deal had been done on developing potential energy surfaces for chemical reactions, and also developing the dynamical treatments. These procedures that we used in 1930 and the 1930s are considerably out of date now. They're not, they paved the way for the later work, but of course no one does the calculations in the way that they were done at that time.
Excuse me, Hirschfelder had left by this time?
Hirschfelder had left, I think, about a year before I arrived, and he and Eyring had done a lot of very important work on potential energy surfaces and dynamics on the surfaces. Nothing had been done, however, on extending transition state theory to apply to different kinds of reactions, and I think we were perhaps the first, well, we certainly were the first to look at overvoltage, and this was at Glaston's suggestion. He saw that the theory could be applied to the phenomenon of overvoltage, and that I think was a very useful contribution, that application, and one still sees that work quoted. The work that I did with Eyring on reactional surfaces, of course, was quite new. No one had looked at surface reactions from the point of view of transition state theory. So what we did was perhaps were able to develop it into different kinds of reactions. Of course, it's also people at the same time are working on diffusion processes from the point of view of Eyring's theory. So he was at that time extending his basic theory into different kinds of processes, as well as developing the basic theory. I should mention in addition that shortly before I arrived at Princeton, Eyring, in collaboration with Taylor and with H.S. Taylor and with Hirschfelder, had worked on the theory of radiation-induced chemical reactions. That was another application of the theory to another kind of process.
One of the most interesting outcomes of your Princeton years was the writing of the textbook known to every student of chemical kinetics, The Theory of Rate Processes, which appeared in 1941. And as you've already mentioned, the co-authors were Professor Eyring and Samuel Glaston. Could you tell us a little bit how this came about and the pains and agonies of the writing?
Yes, well, in my first year at Princeton, Eyring asked me if I would be interested in collaborating with him on a book on the theory of rate processes. And he recognized that he himself was not a particularly good writer. He clearly was not, and he knew he was not. He had difficulties putting things down in a logical order, and he found it irksome to have to write things. In fact, his own his own writing tended to be, he tended to write down what came into his mind, and the result was not always very intelligible. And so he felt there was a need for a book in this. He felt that I had perhaps some skill at writing. I don't think they were very considerable skills, but they were surely better than his. So he broached the subject with me, and I, of course, thought this was a splendid idea, because I had always enjoyed writing things. So we started to work on that, and drafted out a certain amount of the book. And then in the middle of my time at Princeton, Gladstone came along. Now, Gladstone had previously written some very successful books in physical chemistry, particularly. There were two that I remember well that I used as an undergraduate. One was called Recent Advances in Physical Chemistry, and the other was Recent Advances in General Chemistry. And they were extremely valuable, because, of course, we have to remember that at that time there were not many good textbooks of physical chemistry at all. These were very helpful. They weren't exactly textbooks. They were really they covered special topics, but they were extremely good. And when Gladstone arrived, he was in the middle of writing his very large textbook of physical chemistry that later appeared and was extremely successful. And that appeared. In fact, I helped him to some small extent with that textbook by reading the proofs. I read the proofs for him, and that was published shortly afterwards by Van Mossberg. Well, Gladstone arrived with no particular objectives, except that he wanted to write, and so it seemed natural, of course, for us to ask him if he wished to collaborate with the two of us. So that's the way it worked out. And in the end, the way the book really was written was that I prepared a lot of drafts, first drafts, and the quantum mechanics and so on I had drafted out, and Gladstone then took them over and developed them and wrote them in his own style and so forth. Aring, in fact, did very little of the writing. We went to him constantly for advice if we had difficulties about this. And of course, he read it all very carefully, and he commented, and on occasion we got into arguments about how things should be put and so forth, and he was very helpful in that way. But I don't believe he spent very much. In fact, my recollection is that he spent almost no time just sitting down writing a section. So it was a rather curious kind of collaboration. It was really, Aring really was inspiring the subject matter. I was drafting out sections, and Gladstone was polishing them up. That was a good experience for me, because I learned a lot about how to write from Gladstone.
The transition state theory is, of course, of special interest to me personally, but it was also a highlight in Aring's career. Can you say a little bit about the reception at the time that this book was being written? Do you think that Aring was aware that this was a very fundamental contribution to kinetics?
Yes, I think he certainly was well aware of that. In fact, I think perhaps, as was true of people at that time, perhaps he even exaggerated the importance in the sense that he tended to say from time to time that the experimental chemists were now really out of business, because he could calculate anything, because he could calculate a potential energy surface that quantum mechanics would give you the exact answer as far as the energetics were concerned, and that when having got a potential energy surface, then transition state theory, as we now call it, could be used to calculate the rate. And he felt that there was really no more left than that. Of course, he realized that the theories were imperfect as they stood, but he thought that a little bit of polishing up of quantum mechanics would would give one exact potential energy services so that one would know exact activation energies, and that the theory would then lead to exact rates of reactions, and that it would be easier to calculate these rates than to do any experiments. Of course, this was a common, I'm not criticizing the fact that he said that, this was quite common at the time, and Dirac had a similar attitude to quantum mechanics. Of course, he felt that quantum mechanics essentially put other people out of business, experimental people out of business. 50 years or so later, of course, we realize that experimentalists still have to do many important things, and it's not easy to see today that these theories are going to be the answer to everything. But indeed, to answer the question, indeed, Aring, without being, I mean, I don't suggest he was being immodest about what he had done, because he wasn't that kind of a person, but he did think it was of great importance, and of course he was right, it was of very great importance.
Another interesting historical event which happened around the same time was a simultaneous paper by Polanyi and Evans along very similar lines. Do you recall any special outcome from this episode?
I'm not familiar with background. Evans had worked in the Princeton Chemistry Department a couple of years or so, I believe it was, before Aring's paper appeared. Aring told me that Evans had discussed reaction rates with him, with Aring. Evans, in fact, worked with H.S. Taylor, however, so that there was not a close association, but undoubtedly Evans was made aware of the work that was done by, that was being done by Aring and Hirschfelder and collaborators at that time. I'm not sure that Hirschfelder had arrived, perhaps, when Evans was there. I'm not sure of that, but anyhow, Evans was certainly aware of the approaches that were being made by Aring on with regard to transition state theory. Now, there was some question at the time as to whether perhaps Evans had learnt quite a bit from Aring, and that then had gone and worked it up with Polanyi. Same time, we have to remember that Polanyi had been corresponding with Wigner, and in fact in their paper they did acknowledge that Wigner had helped, was very helpful to them, and of course Wigner was very familiar with what Aring was doing, so there's no question that people were not suggesting that anyone was stealing anybody's ideas. It might have appeared, perhaps to some, that there was that question, but it was all really out in the open. And my own view now is that, although I've heard alternative ideas, but my own view now is that everything was really quite straightforward about that. There was nothing improper done by anyone in that connection.
Well, certainly not known to each other, shall we say.
No.